JSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.
You're listening to Simon Fraser, Campus Radio on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we discuss how the NDP leadership race could turn the party into a vehicle for bold left politics or cement its decline on The Breach Show. Talk about the health risks of zoonotic diseases and the political circus surrounding a flock of ostriches on Press Progress Sources. Look back at the 1919 Winnipeg General Strike on Anti-Empire Project and explore Marxism, Chinese culture, and ecology on Cited. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. And broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, Desmond Cole sits down with Martin Lukacs to discuss how the NDP leadership race could either turn the party into a vehicle for bold left politics or cement its decline. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. The race to choose a new leader for the Federal New Democratic Party, the NDP, is now underway. Five candidates have been approved so far, and they're making their pitches to members and to people that they hope to sign up during the March 2026 convention. Today, we're going to talk about the candidates, about their visions for a party that lost a lot of ground in the last election, and about the campaign teams that they've assembled to contest the leadership. And to do that, I am joined today by Martin Lukacs, the managing editor of The Breach. Hey, Martin.
Hey, Desmond.
So we're just over a month into this race now, and on this program, we have talked a lot about the connection between politics, like capital P, party politics, and our social movements in this country. So, Martin, what do you think that this race means for left-wing movements in Canada?
I think the question that has been foremost in my mind is this paradox that we have to deal with on the left, which is that the left, especially in English Canada, is organizationally very, very weak. And yet, our ideas are extremely popular. So, you know, across the board, people want, you know, the wealthy to pay more. They want a Green New Deal that transitions Canada off fossil fuels. They want to see our social programs strengthened, defunding the police, honoring treaties, and doing right by Indigenous peoples. Majorities or supermajorities of Canadians support these kinds of policies. And they are popular among a multiracial working class, among immigrants, Indigenous peoples, young, downwardly mobile graduates. While we've had several, you know, really vital and vibrant movements emerge in this country, you know, in our generation, whether it's Idle No More or Black Lives Matter or the student movement, they're often a flash in the pan. The labor movement as well has been showing signs of increasing militancy, but it's still mostly fighting defensive battles. And so we have this potential social majority for these progressive ideas, but they, I think, need to be organized into a political majority, one that, you know, actually sees itself as connected, has a common adversary, and can actually build the kind of collective power and strength that we need to win these transformations in society. And part of the problem that we have, besides the, you know, lack of unified strength among social movements, is that we don't have a political vehicle to advance that project. And the question is, can the NDP be that vehicle? I'm not certain, but I think that experiment needs to be undertaken. And I think too many of us kind of have like a moral approach to politics. They want the NDP to be a perfect reflection and expression of their politics. But the thing is, we don't need to write Valentines to the NDP. The NDP is an institution. It's a site of struggle through which we might be able to advance some of our causes and some of our politics. And we can't just snap our fingers and manifest the perfect vehicle, especially electorally. But I do think we can fight to transform it. And a leadership race is a chance to do that. And these chances really come around once in a decade, sometimes once in a generation. Parties that are as top down as the NDP can only really, I think, be transformed from the top down and then opened up to social movements. And so I think we have a moment now where we could potentially turn the party into a lever of, you know, popular political mobilizations, a party that champions the causes of social movements and actually offers a more distinctly radical governmental perspective on change. And I think there's a real urgency to the task because we have a rightward racing government in Mark Carney that will do nothing really, I think, to transform the daily economic crisis that people are living in this country. And so if we can't mount a left populist alternative via the NDP, I do think that the forces that will benefit will be the right in Pierre Poilievre. And I think that will ensure a very, you know, dangerous and disastrous next few years for Canada.
You know, I think you make an interesting point about people wanting a political party to be perfect or at least ideal, right, before they decide that they're going to get themselves involved. I've definitely seen that and experienced a lot in my life too. But I think the other factor is that people like being invited into something and welcomed into something. And I think the challenge for political engagement in this way is that people just don't feel like they're welcomed or invited to be parts of these big political institutions. And I'm talking about all political parties and a lot of our big institutions generally in Canada. The mentality that you're talking about is a lot more about, you know, seizing an opportunity that is there within a political party rather than waiting to be invited in. And I think that that's counterintuitive to a lot of people. But, you know, I take your point about it's never going to be perfect. We have to make it, you know, what we want it to be.
Certainly the NDP in the last, you know, few decades has, far from offering an invitation to the left and social movements, it's done the opposite. It's gone out of its way to alienate movements. It's been part of this, you know, long-term transformation of the party into one that's focused on, you know, the personality of the leader, focused on, you know, an air war, focused on trying to moderate its politics, chasing this shifting mirage of the political center. And what it has meant is that the NDP in its current state, both federally and provincially, is almost entirely cut off from the energy, the ambition, the politics of social movements, which to my mind are always the driving force of transformation in this country.
Okay, when we last talked about the NDP race in the summer and we were looking forward to the moment that we're in now, the leadership of the party was deciding what the rules of this campaign were going to be.
There was quite a remarkable feat for the grassroots left wing of the party over the summer. The party's establishment, I think, had been very interested in having as short a race as possible, with as high an entrance fee and potentially a voting system that stripped members of their one member, one vote, you know, democratic system. And I think the intention was to ensure that a more establishment friendly candidate would be able to rely merely on the existing and diminished base of the party's membership, and they would just be able to tie it up very quickly. Whereas the grassroots left of the party was interested in having a lower entrance fee and as long a race as possible to ensure that, you know, potentially insurgent candidates could make their case, not just to the NDP's existing membership, but many of the members who have left the party in frustration, or many people who are progressive minded but have never felt, you know, a potential home in the NDP. And remarkably, the Federal Council, which is the governance, main governance body of the NDP, defied the wishes of the establishment. Usually, they have acted as nothing more than a rubber stamp. But in this case, the Federal Council got organized and they actually won a really important initial victory, which was to ensure that this race would actually extend over 5-6 months. So instead of wrapping up around September, October, November, it's going to be continuing until the end of March, which I think gives members and Canadians more broadly a chance to really take a close look and understand what the stakes are of this race and what the different distinct options are.
Okay, now we want to talk about the candidates, obviously, but before we do that, before we go further in this conversation, our audience should know, Martin, that you are not a neutral observer in this leadership race. So before we talk about the candidates, why don't you tell us about that?
Definitely. I'm not just an observer. I'm very much a participant in this case. And it's important to put that on the table. I've known Avi Lewis, one of the candidates, for more than a decade. We've worked together on documentary films like This Changes Everything, The Leap Manifesto, and I've become one of his political advisors. And I am excited about him running. You know, as for how that impacts the work that we do at The Breach, I think that we have always practiced a more honest journalism than you get in the establishment media, where we're transparent about our, you know, unapologetically left-wing views and values, and in this case, our commitments. But we still try to be rigorous in our reporting and our evidence gathering and fair in our arguments and judgments. And so we wear our politics on our sleeve, and I'm doing that in this case. And then we let people judge our journalism as they will. And The Breach will remain a home for, you know, critical viewpoints of the NDP. And people should not assume also that my position is shared by all people at the Breach.
Yeah. And I want to add that our team, I feel like here, definitely shares a general political orientation, a left progressive political orientation that is reflected in the work that we bring people every day. But as individuals, we all bring different opinions to this work. And despite your personal support for Avi, you know, I want to reassure our audience that that isn't going to change. You know, for myself, I've personally not gotten involved with any candidate in this contest. And I'm hoping that the way I can contribute is just by giving the best reporting and analysis on this race as I can, as we always try to do here at The Breach. So with that, let's talk about the 5 officially registered candidates in this race, Martin. And I'm just going to give people a brief little bio of each of them in alphabetical order. So we begin with Rob Ashton. He's the president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union of Canada. Those are dock workers. And he's got over 30 years of experience in union movements. Rob Ashton's pitch is basically that working people are being taken advantage of by the ultra rich, and that the NDP needs a plain-spoken leader like himself who is in touch with the lives and needs of working people. Next, we have Tennille Johnston. She is a city councillor in Campbell River, British Columbia, a social worker, and the director of a provincial First Nations health authority. And Johnston also happens to be the first person from a First Nation to run for the federal NDP leadership. She's a member of the Wewakai First Nation. So her campaign is focused on those who feel left out of the NDP. Martin, you were mentioning before people who might be in some ways aligned with the NDP but don't feel involved. That's what Johnston is focusing on in her campaign. And there she's talking about First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people, disabled people, members of the 2SLGBTQIA communities, veterans, and seniors. And I think her campaign is sending a clear message of inclusion for people who should feel connected to the NDP, but maybe don't. Next, we have Avi Lewis, who is a journalist, an activist, a university professor. He is the son of former Ontario NDP leader Stephen Lewis. He's also the grandson of former NDP leader, federal NDP leader David Lewis. Avi Lewis's message in this race is a decidedly populist one. It's basically that the economy is working well for the corporate class and against the interests of working people, and he would like to change that. Next, we have Heather McPherson. Heather McPherson is a New Democrat member of Parliament for Edmonton Strathcona. She's been in that role since 2019, and she's also the former executive director of an international development agency. And if people know of Heather McPherson already, it's probably because she was a loud voice within the NDP advocating for Palestinian solidarity and an end to the siege on Gaza by Israel. Her main message in her campaign seems to be that the NDP needs to be a bigger, broader tent, and that its current messaging is sometimes alienating for ordinary Canadians. So she's presenting herself as a kind of uniting figure to expand the reach of the NDP. And then finally, we have Tony McQuail. Tony McQuail is a farmer, an environmentalist, a former Board of Education trustee in Huron County in Ontario, and he's also the former staffer to an Ontario NDP minister during Bob Rae's government in the 1990s. McQuail says that he wants a merger between the federal NDP and the federal Green Party. And he's also trying to reach out to potential voters who feel disillusioned with politics. And he's featuring environmental stewardship quite heavily in his campaign.
There's a highlight from the episode of The Breach Show. Listen to the rest of the conversation wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com, and find more journalism for transformation at breachmedia.ca. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Since launching in October 2022, Sources has provided in-depth interviews with experts and newsmakers across the country from the award-winning journalists at Press Progress. On this excerpt from a new episode, health reporter Brishti Basu sits down with University of Saskatchewan virologist Dr. Angela Rasmussen to talk about the very real health risks of zoonotic diseases and the political circus surrounding a particular flock of ostriches in BC. Now, here's a highlight from that conversation.
In the tiny rural community of Edgewood, BC, where the census says just a couple hundred humans live, the fate of 300 ostriches at a private farm hang in the balance. After 69 ostriches died due to an H5N1 flu outbreak at Universal Ostrich Farms last December, the Canada Food Inspection Agency, or CFIA, ordered a cull of the remaining ostriches, just following their own procedures, to stamp out avian flu. But then the owners of the farm took the CFIA to court to try and stop the cull. And this drew the attention of the current U.S. administration, including celebrity physician and federal health official Dr. Mehmet Oz, who wants to take these ostriches to his farm in Florida. Today, we're going to get into it all. Ostriches, epizootic diseases, and the threat they pose, and the politics of it all, with Dr. Angela Rasmussen, a virologist, professor at the University of Saskatchewan, and an American living in Canada. Dr. Rasmussen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Brishti.
You've got a long list of credentials that qualify you to talk about this exact subject. Can you tell us how you got into it?
Yeah, so I've actually been working on highly pathogenic avian flu in different animal models and different animal species since 2013. The focus of my research is emerging viruses, especially the ones that cause really severe disease. And I really focus on zoonotic viruses, so viruses that can transmit across species, can transmit from animals into humans. And my particular focus is the role of the host in all of this, so the different animals that the viruses themselves are infecting. So this is definitely within my scientific wheelhouse, but how I ended up getting involved in the particular ostrich situation was that one evening I was scrolling Twitter. This was back in May, and I saw that a variety of people who had been part of the trucker convoy in 2022 had gathered at the ostrich farm and were turning this into effectively a social media circus, demanding, you know, that these ostriches be spared from culling. And as somebody who studies pathogenesis in multiple types of animal species, I've given lectures on pathogenesis or the process of causing disease in birds. I was very interested actually scientifically in how these, you know, how sick do ostriches get? Because H5N1 and other types of high path avian flu cause different amounts of disease. This is actually one way that it spreads, is that ducks don't get very sick from it. So they fly around, they visit different poultry farms, and then they infect the chickens and the turkeys that might be at those farms. The reason it's called highly pathogenic avian flu is specifically because of what it does in chickens. And in chickens, it's extremely lethal, usually 100% mortality in most chicken farm outbreaks, same with turkeys. So there's really a spectrum of different types of disease severity. And I was just curious, you know, what does it look like in ostriches? There hasn't actually been that much research on this. There have been big outbreaks in South Africa where ostriches are actually originally from, and there's a lot of ostrich farming there. And there have been sort of variable results. It kind of depends on the age of the ostrich. It depends on the virus that's circulating. Clearly in these ostriches, you know, 69 ostriches died, according to the owner's accounts. So it was certainly lethal. That may have been age dependent. It's unclear why some of the ostriches lived and some of them didn't. But definitely these ostriches did have a virus that killed at least some of them. So that question was somewhat answered. But then I'm pretty outspoken. And as you pointed out, I am American. I've been very interested in what's happening in my home country with regard to public health. And from my observations, you know, a lot of the attacks on science essentially in the U.S. by the current administration really started with stuff like what's happening at the ostrich farm, politicizing what is normally a typical outbreak response. And a lot of this in the U.S. was, of course, due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Many of those same themes that were echoed by the trucker convoy, sort of medical freedom movement, were originally talking points of the January 6th insurrection that happened in 2021 in Washington, D.C. So I was very interested in not seeing this type of thing happen in Canada. And so I continued to follow the situation. And boy, what a labyrinthine ostrich hole it has become. This is a really complicated situation. But to me, scientifically, it's actually quite clear. And I'm happy to talk more about all of the issues as I see them.
Let's get into it. Yeah, talking about the risks of H5N1 and how it potentially spreads. We know about Canada's very first human case of H5N1 in November last year, just before the ostriches started dying. A 13-year-old girl was hospitalized in BC. She was in the hospital for 2 months with a critical case, and we still don't know where or how she caught the virus. What does this tell you about the spread of H5N1 and what the threat is here?
Yeah, so I think the threat is actually quite high. And, you know, one of the reasons I think we haven't seen more cases in Canada is that, from my observation anyways, CFIA actually does a really good job of helping people establish good biosecurity protocols and guiding people who do work on farms, who do work with birds that might be affected by this, to have proper protection. So the 13-year-old in BC who was infected by an unknown source. She had not had any reported contact with sick animals or birds, hadn't been to a poultry farm. I don't think her family kept poultry. So it's not clear how she got infected. But I do know from our surveillance work throughout Canada, including work that's been done by CFIA, as well as by some of my academic colleagues, and as well as the surveillance data from the U.S., that H5N1 is virtually everywhere in North America in wild birds. And the fall is bird migration season. And this is exactly what we've seen this year so far. We've seen in the last month, essentially, we've seen multiple outbreaks in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Quebec. In the U.S. right now, there are 38 affected flocks across 14 different states, active infections impacting 4.4 million birds. So the virus itself is everywhere. The 13-year-old doesn't necessarily have to come into contact with a chicken farm or a backyard flock. They could just be exposed to bird poop or exposed to birds. And this is one thing that I think people don't realize. We are actually in contact with wild animals a lot more than we think that we are. And in birds, flu is a gastrointestinal infection as well as a respiratory infection. So if you're a really unlucky person, you could just be walking along minding your own business and a bird poops on you and you've just been exposed to high path bird flu. It doesn't happen very often, but in other zoonotic outbreaks, including swine flu outbreaks, including bird flu outbreaks, people have been infected with no known source, and it probably comes from contacting animals or their waste in the environment.
Now, the owners of Universal Ostrich Farms, they are presenting this whole cull as the unjust murder of healthy and helpless ostriches, and the framing is kind of that of an animal rights issue. Here's what spokesperson Katie Pasitny said during a press conference about the farm this month.
These animals are helpless. They're healthy. They live for healthy for 35 years, some of them. They have names. They have names, and they are part of our family.
And then a bit later, I asked her.
Thanks. And you also mentioned, like, you know, the farm has been in operation for 35 years. Can you tell us what was its purpose before 2019?
Yeah, purpose, absolutely. My grandparents got into it, actually, when I was young, and the purpose of it back then was meat. The meat was absolutely, we were trying to make a market for that because it is healthy for diabetics. It's a beautiful red meat, low in cholesterol, and the oil. The oil of an ostrich is extremely therapeutic.
So it wasn't that long ago that the farm was raising ostriches to be killed for meat. Angie, what do the farm's owners claim the ostriches are being used for now?
So this is a very complicated question because the evidence about what they are actually using those ostriches for is very confusing to me anyways. So what they claim is that the ostriches are being used for scientific research. And I've read all the court documents extensively, including the May ruling against the ostrich farm in favor of the CFIA, that really covered a lot of their business activities. According to the ostrich farm owners, Karen Esperson and David Belinsky, in 2020, they read a paper by a scientist in Japan named Yasuhiro Tsukamoto, and he is an ostrich immunologist. This paper actually looked at H5N1, where he immunized ostriches against H5N1 and collected their eggs. Ostriches produce a type of antibody in the yolk of the egg called IgY or immunoglobulin Y that humans don't have, and it can be harvested from the yolks of the eggs. And this is pretty well understood because people have been doing it for a while from chicken eggs. Ostriches do it too, and ostrich eggs are really big. So this scientist in Japan has essentially made this into both a business and an area of his lab's research. So they read this paper about how the antibodies from these H5N1 immunized ostriches protected other chickens against a lethal H5N1 infection. And so they decided that they were going to collaborate with this guy and start doing that with their own ostriches. And their first product was to make antibodies with these ostriches by immunizing them against spike from SARS coronavirus 2 or COVID. They essentially were giving them COVID vaccines, and then they were going to harvest the antibodies out of the yolks and impregnate masks with them. And this would be a way of preventing people from getting COVID. Scientifically, I'm not sure how useful of an idea this is. And it's not clear how much of that they actually did, but this is their professed business idea. They also included business plans in these court filings that said that they were going to immunize the ostriches against other things as well, including digestive enzymes, which they were planning on developing into a weight loss product. They had a whole line of products that they called, I believe it was Ostratrim was the weight loss product. Ostraloss or Ostragrowth, I think, was the hair loss product. So they were going to be making all of these antibody supplements, essentially, for treating all these conditions that really there's no scientific basis to say that they're effective treatments for it. But that was what their business was going to be, and that's the type of scientific research that they claim to be doing. Now, CFIA argued successfully in court that this was not actually a scientific research facility, and this type of work either wasn't being carried out or, you know, this wasn't considered a scientific research laboratory, and I would have to agree, but that is what their stated business was. And, you know, they've also stated that the ostriches have names, that they're beloved members of their family. But what's very confusing about this to me is that there is some evidence based on old Facebook posts, old social media posts, and the Universal Ostrich Farms website that suggested that after 2020, when they shifted their business to this direction, they still were operating businesses in which they were selling ostrich meat, ostrich oil, which is essentially after you butcher an ostrich, they have these large fat pads on their chests that are rendered down into oil that's used to make skincare products and is also a wellness supplement. They were making pet food, they were selling ostrich leather and so forth. This website, anyways, was available up until